Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
The Stack Waddy game, which you try and work out which of these musical aggregations from a certain genre are the figment of my imagination and which ones are real. Are you ready?
Fire away. Go on.
The category is reggae groups. Okay.
Okay. Any particular period or just reggae,
reggae groups in general? Classic reggae groups.
Okay.
And here I've got six names. Do you want to write them down?
Yeah, go on.
Okay. The Gay Lads, the Paragons, the Pioneers, the Tamlins, the Tartans, and the Rankers.
Wow. Hang on. So it's the Gay Lads, the Paragons, the Pioneers, the Tamlins, the Tartans, and what was the last one?
The Rankers.
The Rankers. Wow,
so, which of those?
That's tricky.
It's just been plucked from my fertile imagination.
The Gay Lads, you wouldn't have made up. That's a ska. I'm saying that's a ska group from the early 60s. Nice, innocent, amusing, upbeat name. Paragons and Pioneers, we'll come back to. The Tamlins, again, is not made up. That sounds authentic to me. The Tartans, I'm suggesting, is also real. There'll be some kind of weird Scottish connection. The Rankers, I think, is also genuine. It's between the Paragons and the Pioneers. And I've heard of one, and I think it's the Paragons. Dave, I'm saying that you made up the Pioneers.
No. Pioneers, I think, were the people who gave us long shot kick debucket.
Oh, good God, they did. Oh, for goodness sake.
And
probably an appalling error.
And probably other racehorse themed.
They did, the Pioneers.
So the ones I made out, the Gay Lads real, Paragons real, Pioneers real, Tamlins real, you know, which is extraordinary.
It's
old English folk song, isn't it?
So how many were made up? One of them is made up.
Yeah, the one that's made up is the Rankers.
The Rankers. Okay. God, that's a terrible error about the Pioneers. A public apology, of course. I think I have that record somewhere.
Okay.
All right. Let me try you on... these are American psychedelic groups of the mid to late 60s. Okay.
Right.
Five of them.
Yeah.
Five of them. One is real. One is fictitious and four are real. Okay. Mm-hmm. Liberty Cap.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Bubble Puppy.
Yeah.
The Golden Dawn.
Yeah.
Frumious Bandersnatch.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. And Ant Trip Ceremony. That's Liberty Cap, Bubble Puppy, Golden Dawn, Frumious Bandersnatch. And Trip Ceremony. Over to you.
Three more from them after the news. God. Well, I've not heard of any of them. They don't even ring a distant bell. So I'm gonna proceed on the basis that which is the one that you might have made up.
And I
can only imagine that the only one you could possibly make up is Golden Dawn.
Oh, right. Okay. No, Golden Dawn is real.
Oh, okay. Right.
Golden Dawn are real. They're a band from Austin, Texas in 1966. I hadn't heard of them either, nor had I heard of Frumious Bandersnatch, which is such an obvious name, really, isn't it? Somebody must have done something from Jabberwocky around that time, don't you think?
Is that what it is?
Oh, yeah. It's from Jabberwocky. I mean, why isn't there a band called the Slithy Toves?
Yes.
Gyre and Gimble.
Sounds like Spiggy Topes and the Turds.
It is slightly Topes.
The Private Eyes.
It is, absolutely. Ant Trip Ceremony, also genuine. Yeah, they're an American psychedelic rock band from Logan in Utah, 1967. As were Bubble Puppy, bubble popping from 67 to 72. Who had a top 20 hit, Hot Smoke and Sassafras. So the one I made up is also the name of a magic mushroom. So that was the clue that I thought might sound authentic, which is Liberty Cap.
Oh, wow.
So there you go. Well, you win. So no, we both. Yeah.
You obviously know more about magic mushrooms than I that I thought you did. It's not my specialist subject at all. So, anyway, that's a great stride forward for podcasting again this week. The Snack Waddy game. So what else has been happening this week?
Charlie Daniels died, which is an amazing story, isn't it?
Why should I laugh? I'm not laughing.
No, we're not laughing. Charlie is just a really interesting character because, you know, you forget that these guys are, I suppose, infinitely more right-wing than you remember that they were. You know, I mean, Charlie Daniels, big pal of the Southern Rock circuit, wasn't he? Did some extraordinary things. You know, played on a couple of Dylan albums, I think. Three Dylan albums.
Oh, he did, didn't he?
Yeah, he played bass and guitar on things like New Morning. And, if I remember rightly, was in the touring band with Leonard Cohen when they played the Isle of Wight Festival. So for that incredible performance by Leonard Cohen, Cohen is clearly absolutely stoned out of his brain. He just claimed to be on Mandrax, didn't he?
Probably on Liberty Cap. I don't know this.
And there in the background, I think you'll find Charlie Daniels playing the fiddle. But very interesting guy because, you know, you seem like such a caricature, really. You've kind of, you know, I'm born in the 1930s, check shirts, the kind of cowboy hat, chewed tobacco.
Yes.
He used to chew tobacco. And he was on the Letterman show famously about, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago and showed Letterman how to chew tobacco.
Oh,
and gave him
some.
Which is bizarre, isn't it? I know.
Have you ever chewed tobacco?
No, that sounds...
It's a horrible idea, doesn't it? Dear?
Awful. But all those quite... I suppose, somebody born in that era, you'd call them kind of patriotic, but it did seem extraordinary. The record's this ain't no rag, it's a flag. He did a song in 1990 called Simple Man, which is a big country hit. And it was about the, it called for the lynching of drug dealers and sex offenders.
Without due process of law, my goodness.
I know.
Grief. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, you can never go wrong in America with a song about a flag, can you really? Because they are utterly flag obsessed, more than anybody else on God's earth. He's obviously best known, I suppose, to, was it, The Devil Went Down to Georgia and all that. Didn't he play with the Allman Brothers?
He did, I think.
I've got a feeling he played fiddle.
He certainly played with Marshall Tucker Band. He was with all that lot. Yeah.
Anyway, and so he was known as one of those kind of, one of that select group of musicians who were a kind of welcome in the contemporary White House alongside Kid Rock who else? I've gone blank.
Kanye West, probably no.
Kanye West has recently disavowed Donald
Trump. Yes, he has. He's washed his hands of Trump
in somewhat confusing circumstances. Anyway, there were so few rock stars likely to get an invitation to the White House that Charlie Daniels was quite prominent among them. But and he died. What was he? 83 or something?
He's
83.
He's 83. Born in 1937.
But the story going around on the internet, presumably with absolutely no basis in fact, was that he'd made a deathbed conversion to Islam. This got quite a lot of traction on the internet for a day. It's extraordinary.
That has to be one of those examples of that convention whereby if somebody dies, there's a race to get on and hack into their Wikipedia site and alter their kind of CV with one crucial and ridiculous fact in the hope that it'll turn up in obituaries. Maybe that's the case. Maybe that's what... Was this mentioned in any obituaries?
I haven't read any obituaries. It's kind of... The internet is the obituary nowadays, isn't it, really? It gets there before the official obituaries have done their work. So, sort of rather black humorous, blackly humorous... Full stop on the Charlie Daniels story.
No, it is. There aren't that many right-wing musicians, are there? I was trying to remember who the famous ones were. I mean, very few people go out and nail their colours to that particular mask. Johnny Ramone, you remember, declared God bless President Bush at the Hall of Fame in 2002, which was really unusual, really. Especially as a member of the Ramones, you know. Phil Collins, I think, said he'd leave the country if Labour got elected in 1997. I mean, apart from that, there's very few. Morrissey, a bit, I think, called it right. Ted Nugent. Shooting deer and generally being a kind of redneck good old boy, isn't he?
Yeah, it's kind of, there's right-wing and right-wing.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. They're different
things. And in the world of popular music, they tend to have a fairly broad definition of right-wing.
Yeah.
I.e. everybody not quite like us. You know?
Exactly. Yeah.
That's the way it's looked at. And, it's still interesting to me that... the opening track of Revolver is Taxman, you know, which is a song about paying too much tax. Nobody would be doing that nowadays.
No, they wouldn't. Although I remember feeling huge sympathy for them at the time, because I thought that was absolutely appalling. That the Beatles, who deserved, you know, as much money as possible, were getting ruinously punished.
Well, because the rate of tax and surtax, super tax, whatever, in those days was absolutely, mind-boggling.
It was monumental.
It was in the 90% and so forth.
Yeah.
But it wasn't controversial to say it at all in 1966.
No, it wasn't.
It would now be the single most controversial thing you can say. Although, as we're going to go on to discuss... there are more controversial things that you can discuss in popular music nowadays.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
Kasabian, yeah? I don't know an awful lot about Kasabian, but they're very popular. But obviously, we've all learnt a lot in the last week about Tom Meehan, singer of Kasabian, who was... well, he's pled guilty, hasn't he?
It's a sad old story. I mean, I think he's obviously been, been going on for some time. It's a domestic violence charge. It's a really, really sad story. And I felt really sorry for that band because they were saying, we've worked so hard for 23 years and we're in a position where we're, set up at this particular level and we had a great future ahead of us. But, I mean, it's also interesting, isn't it, about how attitudes, our attitudes towards people in bands. Out came the announcement. It was kind of like a corporate press release, don't you think? He said he was stepping down by mutual consent from the band. Yes.
Yeah.
And
whatever happened to mutual, musical and personal differences?
I know. I thought that was interesting. It was a bit like he was spending more time with his wife and family or whatever, or that his values were not consistent with those that fans have a right to expect or whatever. It's just, he was off brand sort of thing. I mean,
that's the interesting thing, to me, that it's very difficult. I mean, it's really difficult in a band, isn't it? Because as you say, they've worked all that time to build up whatever they built up, which is quite considerable.
Yeah, it is.
And then kind of at a stroke, it's gone, isn't it? It seems to be, which is, it's irrational, really. I mean, because obviously he's guilty of whatever he's guilty of, and they've decided that he's left the band, and fair enough. But that shouldn't really kind of... it shouldn't really affect Kasabian any more than if a footballer was caught, found guilty of doing the same kind of thing at a prominent football club and would be asked to leave the football club. The football club wouldn't suffer as a consequence, would it? People wouldn't stop supporting whoever it was.
No, they would
because
say
of that.
Bad stuff happens and he'll be replaced. I mean, they could obviously carry on. He could replace him, but half the problem is he's a singer. The drummer or the bass player.
That's the thing that strikes me, that it kind of, it makes you realise what a strange, irrational thing kind of musical loyalty is. You know what I mean? That it's partly about music, but also almost as much it's about loyalty, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's about, they're my mates, those guys up there. They represent me. And the closer to the front they are, the more they represent me.
Yeah.
And and therefore I could deal with, you know, if the drummer or whatever was shuffled away or was replaced by somebody else. But I find it more difficult with the face of the group. You know,
well, it's the singer of the group is the window through which you enter the whole experience, isn't it? And so that's been, you know, severely tarnished, you know. But it's, I don't know, it's just interesting because it made me think about, you know, rock stars who might have been fired if they'd been in bands in the past. You know, John Martin. If John Martin had been in a band and behaved like John Martin, do you know what I mean?
Oh, well, we were talking to Graham Thompson this week, who's written, Graham's written a splendid biography of John Martin, which is, he'd be going out there as the next word in your ear and will be available for you to hear and see quite soon. But what comes out of that book is John Martin was clearly kind of guilty of domestic violence, wasn't he? And not just domestic violence. I mean, violence generally, you know.
Oh, yeah, there's one point where he takes on 12 people in a Birmingham restaurant. I mean, kind of touchingly, because they racially insult the waiter. But he takes on 12 people, nonetheless, knocks two of them unconscious. And you just think, this is something. And his whole kind of utterly self-interested, you know, narcissistic kind of, you know, chaotic way of dealing with the world. There's one manager who eventually says, I've had enough with him. I can't work with him any longer. And when asked why, he says, he's just broken two of my ribs. And you think, well, if you were in a band with somebody who behaved like that, it would put a strain on relations, wouldn't it? Warren Zevon's another. We did a podcast about Warren Zevon not that long ago. And, oh, my God, you know, the guns and the drugs and the booze and the just utter debauchery. And, you know, it would be, you couldn't live with it.
But it's, you know, there have been cases of this happening in bands, you know, quite prominent bands. I mean, Brian Jones, you know, was very unpleasant to a lot of women in his life. You know, they eventually just wanted to edge him out. Now, fortunately, if you like, by then he'd rendered himself so ineffective by substance abuse and whatever that they had good musical reasons to get him out of the group as well.
But I think he had to concede that they probably had a point. But
there was also the problem that by then he was just a prick.
A complete prick. And God, what an extraordinary guy. They looked up to him so much when they met him, didn't they?
Yeah.
I mean, they were impressed by the fact that, if I remember rightly, he became a dad when he was 17. Yeah. I think possibly twice in the same year, actually. He had three kids by the age of 19. He had five kids by the age of 23. I remember Keith and Mick being really impressed, actually, because they'd never met anybody of their age group who was a parent, you know. But very soon that began to wear off when they saw all the other aspects of his character.
Yeah. And so it's just one of those, I mean, if you think back, you know, I'll throw this challenge out to everybody. If you think back to your kind of, I don't know, your mates at college or when you're 18, 19 or whatever, your social circle, which is, it's a long time ago, but it will probably have turned out to include somebody that you really wouldn't want to have anything to do with nowadays. You know what I mean? There will be somebody who was guilty of something or, you know, went over the edge, or there just will be. And whereas, you know, you exclude them from your life. You have done that gradually over a period of time. If you're in a pop group, you can't do that.
Well, you're wedded to them, aren't you?
Because you're wedded to them.
You're married to them. I mean, that's the extraordinary thing, isn't it? It either works on the inside or it works on the outside, as it were, to the audience, or ideally both. But you can't, it changes the equation. It changes the dynamic so much to have to get rid of them, doesn't it?
It's really hard.
No matter which member it is, it's still not quite the original band.
And also, if you have a kind of a member who is unstable, you know, let's just put it that way, the pressures of ups and downs of success are going to make them even more unstable, because they're coming under pressures most of us don't have to come under, you know, which is the, you know, the what happens in the music business is either nobody wants to know you, or everybody wants to know you. There's nothing in between. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're dealing with terrible black rejection or mad acceptance.
And both those things are equally difficult to deal
they're
with.
They're really
and
difficult.
The, and the worst aspect of that is it often goes from one to the other and back to the former very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Which is why they always say that, you know, it's so hard being the person who's in the relationship with the person on their way up. Oh. Because the moment they're on the way up, they're lost to you because the whole world wants to talk to them. And the moment they're back on the way down, they're sitting at home moping about the fact that nobody loves them. So you only ever get to see the bad side of it and don't really get a share of the good side.
No, no.
Which is really, really tricky.
But, and, you know, so these people are... And it's almost, you know, musicians will tell you that they're a nightmare when they come off the road because, you know, they just can't decompress. They can't go back into normal life because actually, although they may be relieved that the tedium of the touring is over, they kind of miss it at the same time, you know, because it provides a rhythm to the day, which is just gone when all you have to deal with is put the rubbish out, you know, and do the washing up and take the kids to school and all that kind of thing.
I know, going from a kind of final night at Madison Square Garden to being back, you know, 24 hours later going to Tesco or something, yeah. You know what I mean, in Crouch End. That must be so hard. Musicians have told me repeatedly when they come off tour that their body starts to react at about 6 o'clock, you know, they think they should be doing a sound check or whatever. They're getting pumped up to go on stage. Adrenaline is firing through their system. And then there's no gig to play. So you're sitting at home with the kids and you've got to somehow kind of deal with that and calm down. That must be so hard.
So none of this is obviously to excuse anything that Tom Meehan may have done. I suppose it's just to reflect on the fact he's surprisingly doesn't happen more often.
I know.
You know,
think of other people in bands who actually were fired from Maiden Band. I mean, there was Sid Barrett was eventually booted out.
They just decided they couldn't deal with
him. They didn't pick him up.
Because he frightened them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because that kind of thing can happen.
Ozzy Osbourne, I think at some stage was
yeah, they took him back. Because he overdid it, and then they brought him back.
They brought him back, and they weren't quite the same without him. But I mean, Ozzy, I think he went to Chokey before I found him. I didn't read this in one of your books, actually. Didn't he go to jail for nicking a load of clothes?
That was before Blank Sabbath.
Yeah, and his dad wouldn't pay the fine. You know?
Yes, he's had an old strict, you know, Victorian parent. I'm not paying your fine, son. Go do your bird. How different.
The case that I always imagined must have been so difficult to deal with in a band was Dennis Wilson. Dennis Wilson, who'd been an absolute reprobate from the word go, hadn't he? I mean, absolutely absurd. Yeah. Dennis Wilson, if I remember rightly, at the age of 36, took up with a girl called Sean Marie Love. Do you remember that? Who was 16. They eventually got married. They had a child.
Wasn't she Mike Love's?
She was Mike Love's daughter.
Daughter.
So she was the daughter of his first cousin, who had just released his first cousin. Let's not forget. His first cousin and fellow band member, Mike Love. And he takes up with her and they have a child. I mean, that must have been so difficult to deal with. Oh, my God.
And
David Crosby. David Crosby, the kind of, oh, my Lord. Constantly kind of free, I think arrested at one point on for possession of firearms, that were illegal possession of firearms.
I have to think, you know, how terrible must David Crosby be to have finally alienated Graham Nash? Graham Nash, who appears to me to have saintly patience.
Absolutely saintly.
And, you know, has been kind of married to him since 1969.
Yeah,
and finally had to say, I just can't deal with this guy. I think that must be really tough. He must have really pushed you, you know.
Yeah, but
a lot of this just relates to the fact that they have such long relationships with each other.
Yeah.
Even Kasabian, who I think of as came along yesterday.
No, 23 years.
23 years.
No, it's astonishing.
You know. If the Beatles had stayed together 23 years, they would have killed each other.
Yeah.
You know, something terrible would have happened, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of it's just to do with that kind of, they're locked together.
Rick Danko. Wouldn't he have been hard to be in a band with? Rick Danko. Oh, can you imagine? Can you imagine you go to Big Pink and you start to write the songs and you then decide to record your first albums and they're really successful and the band are ready to go out and tour America. And Rick Danko then just crashed his car, didn't he? Just full of drugs, I mean, finished up in a ditch, broke his neck or something, or broke his back, I think. I can't remember now. But the whole career of the band was derailed by
Danko's
unavailability.
Here's my question. Have we reached the stage now where we're going to see bands or record companies or whatever having HR departments?
So you'd be sort of vetted before you came in. You'd have to sign a contract.
You don't have a contract. That's the odd thing. You know, they'll have contracts with record companies. Yeah. Probably in a lot of cases, they don't have a contract with each other.
Yeah.
And if they did, it would have been drafted when they were 17 and desperate to get a session on the radio or whatever. So it sort of wouldn't mean anything anyway. But it's like you said about the announcement about him leaving the group was kind of like a company announcement. It was, you know, inconsistent with the high values that this company, you know, likes to
represent. Yeah, that's right.
And of course, it's now at its worst because companies now are forever making statements about, you know, we're all in favor, you know, Black Lives Matter, whatever it is, tick, 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 tick. You know, nothing makes any difference how they're doing any business. You know, but everybody has to be seen to represent, you know, stand by the right things. And bands may get to the stage where they have to make this overt. You know what I mean? That these are the brand values of this band going forward. You know, do you sign up to all those things?
And if you in any way transgress, do you understand that, you know, your career is in peril?
You're going to get, you know, a written warning, a verbal warning.
Yeah, that's right, verbal warning. That's right, you'll be put on probation.
You see, this is what's going
to
happen.
Three-month meeting to discuss how it's going.
Annual reviews.
Yeah, that's right.
You get you in there and say, how do you feel it's going? You know, when do you see yourself?
When do you see yourself in 2 months' time? Because I tell you where we see you. Not in this band.
Dear, Lord. So talking of bands involved in strife, have you followed the story of Lady Antebellum?
Yes, well, in as much as they've also had to change their name due to an association with slavery. It was the same story as the Dixie Chicks, wasn't it?
Well, kind of. Is Lady Antebellum a kind of countryish, modern country pop outfit who I always thought at the time, you know, years ago, so I first started hearing this name, I thought, that's a weird name. It's not very euphonious apart from anything else, you know.
It's not. It's hard to say.
It's really hard to say.
Hard to say. It looks odd.
But Antebellum is obviously the expression for, it's certainly in American culture, before the war, you know. So they talk about the Antebellum South, which conjures up visions of white mansions and plantations. All that kind of stuff. And so they started off with this name and they started thinking about changing it some while ago, but have suddenly decided they really got to change it. And so they've changed it. They want to change it to Lady A. Get rid of the Antebellum word because of its associations. But now they find themselves in a lawsuit against a musician who was already trading as Lady A, and so she's wanting, you know, either $10 million or whatever to take the name away.
Fair enough. She knows they're desperate. She knows they're in a corner.
Absolutely. And I looked into this, you know, that how did they come up with this name? And they were doing a photo shoot early in their career on the veranda of some mansion or somewhere in the South, and somebody said, oh, it's got a real Antebellum vibe to it. And so they thought, oh, that's a good idea for a name. And apparently they didn't know the association to the word, which...
That can't be true.
Was a pretty terrible, pretty damning indictment of the American educational system.
Indictment all round, isn't it? Yeah. How could you not? Also, it's such a curious word. Wouldn't you be naturally inquiring about what it meant?
but there they go, you know. So I mean, it may be, maybe wonder if there are any other groups out there looking nervously at their names of old associations. I mean, we were talking to Will Birch, weren't we, this week about I think the name of Stephen Stills Manassas came up.
Yeah.
And Manassas were named after the
Battle of the Civil War.
First Battle of the Civil War, yeah. Won by the Confederacy. So there was even a group, there was a funk group in the 70s and 80s, I think, called Slave, which was signed to Atlantic, I think they were.
Were they presumably black musicians?
I think they were. Yeah, they were multiracial, I think.
Yeah.
I can't entirely remember. And so, you know, all that stuff's getting frantically reviewed in the light of current circumstances. And
in the light of a state agent saying you can no longer refer to a master bedroom.
Okay.
The word master implies, ruling class.
Oh, really?
Good God. Oh, no.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. So, you know, and that's just this year. It'll be something else next year. Names are a bit of hostage to fortune, aren't they, really? I don't know what the learning of this is. You've got to pick a name that's kind of completely uncontroversial. Can't possibly be controversial in any sense.
Yeah, the Dixie Hummingbirds were in a bad position, weren't they?
The Dixie Hummingbirds, who were still going, a great venerable, black gospel quartet, I think. And they were going 30, 40 years ago and are still going to this day. And I don't think there's any plans to change their name to The Hummingbirds.
The Hummingbirds.
Like the Dixie Chicks, rather unfortunately changed the name to The Chicks.
Which sounds bad. Oh, I mean, admittedly, it's a name ordained by women, but it still doesn't sound... The Chicks is the worst possible name.
You can't see it. No. You can't see it doing them any good. But that's the way it is.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
I've got a hot TV tip, Mark. And you know what my hot TV tips all have in common? Is they're really cold TV tips, because they're usually things that were on the TV about a year ago that I've only just caught up with. But last night I watched on Now TV The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling.
Oh, right, go on.
Which is the two-part documentary about the great, late great Gary Shandling, the comedian, comic actor. Made by Judd Apatow, who was a kind of friend of his,
knocked up and was, yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was brought along by Gary Shandling when he was quite young. Gary Shandling really mentored him, helped him into the business, and so forth. And so this is obviously his kind of personal, kind of payback, really. To make this film, this 5 hours, I think it is, about the story of Gary Shandling, and it is really interesting, utterly absorbing. Very funny, as you can imagine, because it's got loads of clips of Gary Shandling and loads of other comedians. And also very, very moving in that he clearly never got over the fact that his elder brother died when he was of cystic fibrosis, I think, when he was about 12 years old.
Yeah.
And his mother never processed the loss and so forth. And so this haunted Gary Shandling all throughout his life. And Gary Shandling, he starts the film by showing, getting this just bit clip that obviously was shot before Gary Shandling died, where he introduces Judd Apatow to his drawer full of notes. He opens this massive great drawer and says, "It's all in here." And he gives Judd Apatow all these notebooks. And so what Gary Shandling did throughout his life was he wrote down absolutely everything. Every idea for a joke, for a program or whatever. And also, he wrote to himself, memos to himself, what he should be thinking, how he felt. And so it's an absolute treasure trove for somebody making a documentary. And also, just loads of it was filmed. Hanging about in back rooms in clubs with Jerry Seinfeld and so forth. When Ricky Gervais came to his house, all this stuff, it's all in it. I cannot recommend it too highly. It's absolutely fascinating. And of course, at the core of it is, I don't know if his great show, I think, was the Larry Sanders Show, which was a kind of comedy based on a chat show, on a late night chat show. And his actual girlfriend was in the Larry Sanders Show, who was utterly devoted to him and wanted nothing more than to get married and to have children. And he just couldn't bring himself to commit, you know. And so when he broke it off with her, he fired her from the series straight away.
Oh, God.
And she's in the film and, you know, she's very kind of forgiving and so forth. But it's, boy, is it moving, you know.
That's incredible.
And it brings home to you the kind of people trying to live some kind of normal life while living this utterly abnormal life at the same time. You know what I mean? And it's utterly brilliant and it's full of great gags.
That's fantastic.
You'd absolutely love it.
On the subject of great gags and American comedians, do you remember the old, I was talking to someone about it the other day, do you remember the old Nicholas Parsons, Richard Pryor story?
Go on.
Do you remember that? I always love this story. That Nicholas Parsons was at a party and Richard Pryor had just died. You know, and you remember in Terrible Cirques, I mean, Richard Pryor kind of freebasing, wasn't it? It was just all sorts of terrible things, you know. And I think it was all very complicated. I think, wasn't he born? I think his mother might have been a prostitute.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The details is born in this extraordinary kind of whorehouse, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, this guy goes up to Nicholas Parsons and he's telling all about, you know, Richard Pryor. And you know, in incredible detail, the drug abuse, the whorehouse, the whole life that he grew up in, you know. And Parsons is absolutely just knocked out by this. He just doesn't know how to process his information. He seems to be mortified, you know. And a bit later in the party, somebody goes up to him. And Parsons, let's not forget, was, you know, in his late 80s at this stage and a little hard of hearing. Somebody goes up to him and says, so how's it going, Nicholas? He said, oh, it's all right. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, have you heard about dear old Dickie Briers? I know, it's different. Imagine you'd sat there for half an hour at a party thinking that Richard Briers, a man you'd known from The Good Life and all these other suburban comedies, had actually had a prostitute for a mother and died after a series of disasters involving freebasing on aeroplanes.
You know what makes that gag work? Which Gary Shandling would have been the first one to tell you. It's the word Dicky.
It's Dickie.
It's the idea that to us it's Richard Briers, but to the people in the business, it's Dickie.
It's Dickie.
Dear old
friend. It's a dear old chum.
Anybody who's Dickie, you know, think of the Dickies. Dickie Attenborough, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Dickie Bird.
Yes.
They're kind of all sweet old buffers, aren't they?
Yeah. Really? I know. About as far from free base as you can possibly get. Fantastic.
Oh, that's brilliant. So the Gary Shandling thing, if you can find
that's
it,
worth seeing.
I cannot recommend it.
That sounds really, really good.
Extraordinary. You know, to see a documentary that genuinely gets the story of somebody right from the beginning, right through, is kind of rare. Because obviously, most documentaries, there's a kind of promotional element of most documentaries, isn't they? They're usually there to try and get you to be interested in the next tour or the next film or whatever, whereas this obviously doesn't have that kind of agenda.
No, that's true.
You been watching on the television?
Well, we watched Mrs. America last night. Did you see any of that?
Oh, no.
Cate Blanchett, fantastic. Oh, it's fantastic. Cate Blanchett as this kind of American political activist against the women's lib movement in the 90s. It's based on a kind of true story. She's a phenomenal actress, I think.
All right, okay.
So that's been good.
Oh, well,
the Kemp brothers. You wouldn't have seen this.
No,
the Kemp brothers. I don't know why we just got a bit fascinated and saw a brother. It's actually, I'm very fond of the Kemp brothers. I think they're all right, don't you?
Gary
and Martin. They did a spoof documentary, two of them. And they're such good actors, they can carry it off, you know. Very funny, very light and knockabout and dark, but it's good, yeah.
You see, this is how I approach television. I wait until it's been through the filter of people I know. You know what I mean? So people, if people are still telling me about it in a month's time, I'll watch it.
I go, what? Exactly.
You know, but before then, I don't. Things just take ages to get through to me. I started watching The Bureau. Have you seen The Bureau, which is the French series about? It's kind of like the French Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, really.
Oh no, I saw you tweeting about that. Yeah, yeah.
It's very good, but then I got to episode 11, and I saw there was a scene I found too upsetting. I couldn't go any longer. Couldn't go any further.
Give me the basic circumstances without giving me the gruesome details. What was
this is how cleverly tension works. Sorry, spoiler alert if anybody wanted to watch this. There is a woman, a middle-aged woman, working as a kind of secretary for a Syrian spy master, sinister security chief. And she is persuaded by the French intelligence that she's got to place a tracking mechanism in his shoes. And so she waits and takes off his shoes to say his prayers, whatever, and changes them over and whatever. And in the next episode, it becomes clear that he's discovered this. And so he calls her in and he fires her and he makes her go out of the room wearing his shoes. She puts on the men's shoes. I'm sorry. I found it the most horrible, chilling thing. There's nothing else.
That's unsettling.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. That's cruel.
Yeah, that's. I remember having this discussion, but sorry, it's really, really interesting tangent, this. You know Rear Window, the Hitchcock film Rear Window?
Yeah, sorry. Quite
I love
fantastic film.
And I've always, you know, when we were on holiday with the kids when they were younger, used to sit in restaurants late at night, and I used to tell them the plots of Hitchcock films. Just tell them the idea of Hitchcock films, you know, without going into the gore or anything like that. Just this is how tension works. This is how suspense works. And our youngest saw Rear Window once, and she says she just found it too frightening. Just couldn't bear to watch it again. And I pointed out to her, there is only one thing that's directly frightening in Rear Window. And that's the moment when Roman Burr looks up at the window and realizes he's being watched.
And sees.
That's all.
That's right.
That's all. And all that tension is derived from leading up to that and leading away from that. Nothing that's excessive happens in that film.
Because you feel he's looking at you. Because you're the person looking through the rear window into that apartment, seeing what's going on, and he's looking directly at you, and you feel it's going to be within seconds that he's going to be around there, ashing on, breaking your door down.
So I think that's how suspense, you know, works, and that's how chilling things genuinely work. You know, it's not about piling on the special effects or anything like that. You know, it's just about clicking a switch in your mind where you go, "Oh my God, terrible things may ensue from this." From this particular moment of the thing. So anyway, I hope I haven't spoiled it for anybody who hasn't seen it. It's terribly good. It's terribly good. I may eventually get the courage to watch the final two episodes of the first series. But they went on and did other series. It's very, very good indeed. So, So those are our TV tips. Those are our hot TV tips.
Hot TV tips. Mrs. America, which you've probably already seen anyway, but it's good.
Hot musical tips.
Go on.
I'm trying to find it. We were talking to Graham Thompson yesterday about, which, as I say, we recorded, about his book about John Martin.
And God, that was an interesting conversation.
It was really interesting.
John Martin story is phenomenal, isn't it?
I've been playing loads of old John Martin records. And the one that I can't put my hand on right now, which I played and played twice yesterday, actually, is One World. It's really good.
Which he recorded in Jamaica, didn't he?
I think he probably did.
And there's a Lee Scratch Perry track on it.
And so that's very good. So what else have we got to do? Have we got any Patreon?
We got some new patrons. New patrons, please welcome to the fold the following people: Sean Campbell. Yes.
Clapping them into the arena. Thank you very much.
Stephen Clark. Paula Gallagher.
Have a drink.
Yeah. Colin Morrison.
Oh, excellent.
Take a turn. Graham Drummond.
Okay. It's always nice to have them.
Alan Williams.
Excellent.
Richard Kelly. Dean Roderick, William Thornton, and Mike Dunn. Thank you so much.
Well, it's very nice, and they'll be possibly joining us in the quiz, which is on Friday evenings at 6 o'clock. But also possibly taking part in our future Word in Your Ear recordings and putting their questions to the guest of the recording, if they want to, and taking part in lots of other things. Which will be disclosed somewhere down the line, I suppose. So that's about it for this week. We'll see you on the ice. I don't know what that means.
I like the sound of it.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.